Fangoria has been at it for over 40 years and is better than ever. This magazine is not only gorgeous, it's highly collectible and delivered right to your front door 4 times a year. Each issue is filled to the brim with articles exploring every nook and cranny of genre filmmaking, past, present, and future, with all the most exciting journalists, filmmakers, and horror know-it-alls to guide the way, including yours truly. This high-quality writing will only ever appear within the physical pages of the magazine, never online, so if you want to join in on the fun, well, you'll need to subscribe. And in order to do that, all you got to do is head over to Fangoria.com and sign up. And if you use the code KINGCAST at checkout, you will save a whopping 25% off of your subscription. That's Fangoria.com, code KINGCAST. Now on with the show.
Hi. My name is Stephen King.
The ice is gonna break!
Bedlam! Bedlam!
You guys wanna go see a dead body?
Well, sometimes that is better.
Hello and welcome back to the KINGCAST on the Fangoria Podcast Network. My name is Eric Vespi and I am your host for this episode. And it's an exciting one as I'm welcoming a longtime friend of mine on to talk about one of my all-time favorite Stephen King stories. Well, technically Richard Bachman stories, but we'll get into that later. You'll know him as a voice actor, a face actor, and one of the co-founders of Rooster Teeth, who created the early online sensation Red versus Blue and used that to launch a giant business that gained millions of dedicated followers, all because some very funny dudes decided that it would be a good idea to make up some stories while playing Halo. These days, our guest lives in Scotland, as you do, and puts out a daily podcast with his wife and my former boss, Ashley, called Morning Somewhere, available wherever you get your podcasts. Today, he is joining me to talk about a mutual favorite King title and one that is currently getting its first big screen adaptation, courtesy of Mr. Francis Lawrence. That's right, we are going to be talking about The Long Walk. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Bernie Burns to the KINGCAST.
Hello. How are you doing, Eric?
I'm doing great. I thought about going really big at the top because that's how you launch your show. I guess yours is, you know, kind of a wake up for people. So your podcast is more meant to be like a jolt of caffeine, right?
It's supposed to be part of a daily ritual. So it's a daily podcast Monday through Friday. So I was one of those people that I would always listen to the same morning show. Mm-hmm. And just that, I think, you know, mornings are ritual and routine, you know, even for breakfast. You can eat the same thing every day for breakfast, and that's perfectly fine. If you ate the same thing every day for dinner, you would be a psychopath. But for some reason, breakfast, you can eat the same thing all the time. So I like the ritual of the morning. And so, yeah, that first kickstart of get you going was harkening back to the days I would listen to morning shows like Howard Stern or Body Bones and people like that.
Right. Yeah, and it's a great show, and you very smartly decided to make it not very long, which as somebody who has to edit all the shit that we've done for the KINGCAST for the last 4 years, I am insanely jealous of, because every once in a while, like this past week's main feed episode, last week's episode was a great conversation with me, a special guest co-host, Neil McRobert from the Talking Scared podcast, and Stephen Graham Jones, the author. And we were talking about Stephen King's latest short story collection. That motherfucker was like 2 hours 40 raw.
Wow.
When you stare down the barrel of that, when you're having to edit it and cut out a lot of the ums and you knows and what's, that's when I start daydreaming about your show and going, it would be so nice to have like 20 minutes max, you know?
It is nice, and there's sometimes where we'll be done with it, and we've recorded 35 minutes, but you're looking at cutting out almost 50% of it. It's like, oh my gosh, it seems insurmountable, but it's still only 35 minutes at the end of the day. We like Eric said, we live in Scotland, and we try to play that whole time zone against it. So we're not going to wake up at 4 a.m. to make a morning show, because we live 6 hours ahead of our former home in Austin, uh-huh. Texas. We can record that morning show at like 10:30 a.m. So it's much more our speed for a morning show, and it still comes out for everyone else at 6 a.m. when they wake up. But it's nice because our whole production time at this point, man, I hate to even tell you, we're down to like 45 minutes to an hour total, basically, to get the whole thing done every day.
You're twisting the knife, my dude.
Sorry, buddy.
That just means we have to get way more people signed up to the KINGCAST Patreon so I can hire an editor and not even have to deal with it. So just do that.
That's so, patreon.com/
The Kingcast. Patreon.com/The Kingcast. Sign up. You get a bonus episode every Friday. We don't fuck around over there.
You have so much experience editing in general because you were like a classic editor of the written word for so many years. I would watch you every year. We've known each other a really long time. Mm-hmm. I would watch you for, you know, Quint's Christmas Guide. Was that the name of it?
The Holiday Gift Guide, yeah.
Holiday Gift Guide, that's it.
Yeah.
And, man, you would edit that thing forever. I'm like, dude, you're telling people cool products to buy. And you were like, I got to make this interesting, got to make it a worthwhile read. It's like watching you pour yourself into that for – sometimes it was weeks on that thing.
Yeah, no, it was usually when you add in research, it was about 6 weeks of like dedicated 9-to-5 style work. I would always hit, so my deadline on that was always before Black Friday. So it would be, I would usually post on Thanksgiving. That was my thing. And it kind of became a little bit of a ritual for the readers. And still to this day, I haven't done a gift guide in 5 years, maybe. I helped Slash Film when I was with them. I helped them like assemble a couple of sections, but I haven't done my own gift guide in a long, 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 long time. And I still get people hitting me up every year around October, early November-ish, going, "Hey, you know, y'all getting any more of them gift guides in you? You got any more of them?" which is great. You know, it's something of a legacy. I'll take it, but goddamn, is it a lot of work. And, you know, and just to be really transparent about it, when I was doing those at Ain't It Cool, the audience was so large at that site that essentially that was my bonus for the year because I would throw in those Amazon links and, you know, make it very, very transparent that, yes, if you click through and buy anything from Amazon, I get a little cut. And it went directly to me. I know there was a lot of people concerned it was going to the higher ups, and it was just like nope, that was my bonus. But there was one year where, no shit, I pulled in over $20,000 just from the gift guide from people clicking through and buying links. I hit that once 1 year, and it never got anywhere close to that again. But that was a good carrot at the end of the stick. And just to be, you know, completely honest, like the last time I compiled the gift guide, like a couple of grand came in, and I couldn't justify the time that it took to put it out, because then, you know, I also had to host it on my own site, and, you know, I had to like build a site up through Squarespace and whatnot. And it was a whole thing. I know that when I was working at Rooster Teeth, like me and Ashley were working on that with kind of, we did the, you know, my version of the gift guide there at RT. And I know that the income from that, everybody was like, "Oh my God, it's going to be great." And they looked at it and goes, "Oh, yeah, for whatever reason." I think there was a lot of factors in there. I know that nobody listening to the Kingcast like gives a shit about this, but I'm going to go ahead and say it anyway, in case there's like 2 or 3 people listening that read my gift guides way back in the day. But they were comprehensive for a reason, and they were really fulfilling putting out. It's just so much work. I couldn't justify the time that it would take to dedicate to doing it. And like you said, it was more than just a list. Like I went through and I curated every section from Blu-rays, physical media, geek furniture, as I call it, which is like, you know, hot toys and that kind of thing, you know, and I would scour the ends of the earth to try to find something really just random and bizarre for, you know, to throw in there. I think one of the things I did that I'm the most proud of still to this day was I had a giant book section. And that was one of my favorites to compile, by the way, because it was real easy to go into a rabbit hole of like all the cool, like indie books coming out, all the cool, like comic book collections that were, you know, hitting and all these special versions of them and all that stuff. It was really fun. And one day I stumbled across, I think it was Aaron Morgan sent me a link to a joke book that was a cookbook. And it looked like just a normal cookbook, but the thing about it was that it was recipes that every single one of them required semen.
Jesus.
But on the surface, and it had a really jokey like name, not like, you know, wasn't glazed donut or something, but it had a name that once you realize that was really apparent that it was a semen cookbook. And I threw it in there just like as a joke. And I never acknowledged that it was a semen cookbook other than like, "Hey, I tried these recipes and, you know, they were a little salty for my taste," and, you know, stuff like that. And then just like made a little joke throwing like in between biographies from like fucking Mel Brooks and, you know, Steve Martin or something, you know. It was just this random cookbook. you know.
It was called. It was really obvious in hindsight. It was called "Come into the Kitchen."
Yeah. So
the great British jerk off.
Oh my God! There would be so many great uses for books like that, little joke books today. But I don't know. It's like I just felt like putting that holiday guide together was something I took a lot of pride in, and it was something that. That like I would get really loopy doing because I was putting in so many hours. There was one year that I did it, and I I was brushing up against the deadline, and I just, for whatever reason, maybe I lost some work at some point. There was something that happened where I was just really behind the eight ball on it, and I really wanted to get it up on time. Don't make a joke about that, Bernie.
I already left it in the rearview mirror.
And I think I was up for, like, awake doing it for, 48, 52 hours.
That sounds like you.
And I was, you know, I never in my life understood I've never taken an hallucinogenic. Like I've had weed and all that stuff, but I've never done like mushrooms and LSD. I've never done that stuff. But I'll tell you what, if you want to do that and can't afford it, all you got to do is deprive yourself of sleep for 2 days and the wall starts moving and breathing. It is very bizarre. I don't recommend it, but I will say that the best sleep in my life I ever had was I did that, and then I went to sleep, and I slept for, I think, 28 hours. I might have been dead. I don't know. But when I woke up, I haven't felt that feeling in my life. I imagine it's the feeling of being born. It was like my skin was vibrating and just radiating warmth. And I had never felt any – it was the most ridiculous thing. I know it's really unhealthy, and I'm very much a – for somebody that's a big boy like me, I'm very – I lean into sleep and not losing sleep and kind of attribute that to a lot of the reasons why I can be a large man that has relatively few health issues because of it. And I'm a big believer in sleep, so I don't recommend it, but – I don't know. You know, that feeling I've had was just fucking incredible.
I did a lot of research on sleep when we made our show Day 5, which, to quickly summarize, is basically sleep becomes fatal. So it's like the apocalypse, but if you fall asleep, you die, essentially.
Yeah.
And it was a great way to have, you know, we didn't have to like put vines on skyscrapers or anything like that, because in 5 days, basically, the world goes to hell because everyone starts to go crazy and it's completely motivated why that would happen. We studied this guy, Randy Gardner. They did an experiment where they kept him awake for 11 days. That's the record. And there were periods in there where they would interview him for lucidity. And at one point, he literally just turned to the side and gave a full acceptance speech for MVP of the Rose Bowl and did wow. it and answered questions to the press that weren't there, and then turned back and picked up the interview with them, with the researchers, like he hadn't missed a beat. Sleep is one of the strangest things of all time.
It's insane. Like when you think of, because you hear all these things about, you know, about, oh, how it's usually, you can hear them in like atheist versus Christian debates and stuff. And Christians are like, but the human body is so miraculous, which is true. It is pretty crazy that we have tissue that will heal itself like fucking Wolverine. You know, it's like it does it very slowly, but it is crazy that you know. That they're just like little cells in your body that stitch yourself together again. You know, it's insane that how the system works, but it's also insane that you have to completely shut yourself down or you go insane and die. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Sleep's kind of a weird thing too. This is going to sound strange because you were talking about atheist versus Christian, but sleep it's such a weird phenomenon to me. It makes me almost believe it. To me, it's like the missing scale in the armor of evolution. Like it seems like something would have evolved that didn't need to sleep and it would have dominated the planet. You know, the fact that everything needs to go unconscious for 8 hours at a time is just, it's wild. And we just all accept it because that's the way it is. You know, I believe in evolution, by the way. I want to be clear about that. I'm just saying,
flat earther and anti-evolution.
But it's just, I spent so much time like looking at sleep for that show. And studying sleep, I'm just fascinated by it. And it makes me wonder, like, how much negative impact has someone like Stephen King had on a global scale just by the amount of sleep that he has stolen from people globally, like an aggregate level? Like, has he been a net negative for a lot of people's health because he's kept them awake?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great segue. I do appreciate that you obviously have a podcast. great segue, but I was also going to use the fact that that plays into the title that we're talking about, too. By the end of it, there's sleep deprivation going on for Mr. Ray Garrity, who is the lead character of The Long Walk, and how that plays directly, I think, into the very end of the story. But let's shift gears into Stephen King stuff. Bernie, what is your Stephen King origin story?
So my Stephen King origin story has to come from my mother, because my mother would just get, like, I grew up in the early 80s, late 70s, like the era of like B. Dalton booksellers, Walden books. So it was always cool, like the paperback covers and the art of it. I actually just got, I think, and please don't tell me if I'm wrong, I think it's a first edition hardcover It, the one that has the reptilian hand that is reaching out,
coming out of the sewer. Right.
Yeah, for the boat. And that is like burned in my brain. But like my mother would read books like, the cover I remember most, oddly enough, is Flowers in the Attic, which is not a Stephen King book. I just remember that for some reason. And she would read all these books, and I was always compelled by the covers.
Is it the hard cover or the soft cover? Because I remember the soft cover because it was one of those where like the cover was die cut, and it was like,
yes,
the face looking out the window, and then you open the cover and it's like, you know, the full drawing of the girl or whatever.
Uh-huh. That's exactly it. That's exactly it. And so and it's like growing up in the 80s too, all the slasher films and everything, horror then was like just it was go back and watch some of that stuff. I was just watching clips from like Andy Warhol's Frankenstein. It was really like off the charts in what it would do to you psychologically, some of that stuff. I feel like it stepped back quite a bit. Or maybe it was my age and it was just more scarring then. But I don't know. My mother was just such a voracious reader. I can't really tell you what the first Stephen King thing I read was, but I know the one that grabbed me was definitely It.
Yeah.
It was – and then over time, having read the full unabridged Stand was just so important to me. Just shaped, you know, what it's the closest I can think of the Stephen King that I've read that was closest to sci-fi was the post-apocalyptic world or the during apocalypse world of The Stand. And just loved it. And I was one of those kinds of kids where if I was reading, my parents didn't really care. I applied that to my own kids later. If they wanted to watch, you know, a movie that was probably beyond their age, I'd say, well, instead of watching a movie, how about if you read a book, you know, instead? And that was the way they could, you know, age themselves up as they wanted to see things.
Interesting.
You know, that were essentially above their pay grade. If they would read it instead of watching it, then I was all on board with that. And
that
was
actually
my parents,
really good. Yeah, I was gonna say that's a really good carrot to use. I'm gonna good parenting note, I think.
And my oldest son is a voracious reader. Ashley, my wife, is an incredible reader when she has time. When we first started dating before kids, she was reading, I swear, like a book or two a week. Hmm. But I was one of those kids. I was like, I can remember staying up with, you know, It, this gigantic book, and literally being with a flashlight under the covers, like something out of a movie. So that I could read in case my parents came in, they wouldn't catch me reading in the middle of the night. What a problem to have for a kid is like, oh no, they're up all night reading.
those are different times though, because they also didn't care where you were for like 14 hours of the day, I'm sure. So
it's true. Then we get on our bikes and go explore the sewers. We literally did that when we were kids.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, Eric, I got to say right before you called me.
Yes.
I was driving through here. I was driving through one of the local towns. There's not many. We live in northern Scotland, so there's not a lot of really big towns here. But there was a river with a bridge, and it was a very wide bridge over it. And as I passed it, there was this like really ominous dark tunnel entrance that went under the bridge. And at the entrance to that tunnel were five kids' bikes just laid down. Like it was just told the story of these kids dropping their bikes and going exploring somewhere under this bridge. And I immediately thought of it. I thought it would have made a great book cover for a re-release of It just alone. And then it's so weird. It's weird how the universe works sometimes. You called me like the next day and asked me if I wanted to come on the KingCast.
Yeah. Well, and this has been something that, one, I love that. And two, are you sure that those bikes hadn't been there for like a couple of weeks at this point? And, you know, maybe those kids are gone. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, no, they're not to return. Well, if they do, Scottish I stole their bikes and pawned them, so that's okay. Coming back to no bikes.
Scottish Pennywise got them. It's totally fine. Well, that's kind of funny because that is, based on my understanding, that was the germ of the idea that began It was the troll under the bridge. That King, I think he said he was he was walking, maybe in Colorado. He was walking somewhere like kind of alone, and he crossed a bridge, and like he was wearing cowboy boots or something, and he heard the clack, 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 and all he could think of was the fairy tale, you know, who's that, you know, the Billy Goat's gruff fairy tale with the troll under the bridge, right?
Yeah.
And he said that that was like the germ of the idea that stuck with him, something that was under the bridge. And then in Bangor, I mean, he never said this part. This is me kind of connecting the dots, but there's a bridge in Bangor that that I think is where he based the bridge in Derry, where Adrian Mellon gets thrown over and all that, because that was a real thing that happened to a gay man in Maine, in Bangor specifically. He got murdered and thrown over a bridge. And he, you know, but you look at that and that's like connected to the river, which runs into the sewer system, and like all that stuff you can tell just kind of started piecing itself together from that thing. So look at that. I think that you stumbled across an actual real close inspiration to the book anyway. So
one of the things I've always wondered about too with Stephen King was I never really heard of a fear of clowns before Pennywise, but I was maybe 11 or 12 when I read it. So did Pennywise, did that push forward that fear that people have clowns, or have people always been scared of clowns? Like were people scared of Bozo the Clown?
People weren't always scared of clowns, but I think John Wayne Gacy might have helped a little bit in kind of turning that image around. I think you can give credit to King for like kind of making a fear of clowns a mainstream thing. Because listen, most kids are terrified of clowns. I mean, I think that maybe I would say it's maybe pop culture has done it, but you know, you see like the old days with Bozo and you know, the circus clowns and stuff, and the kids are eating it up and loving it. But I don't know. In all my memories of kids who would never know who the fuck Stephen King was or ever see an evil clown image, you know, going to Ringling Brothers back when in the 80s, back when it was okay to have a Ringling Brothers circus, you know, where they would, you know, I remember kids freaking out all the time around clowns. So I don't know, you know, clowns are still, I mean, Ronald McDonald's from McDonald's was one of the biggest icons of the 80s. And, you know, notice he's not really around anymore. So
yeah. Have they walked away from it because of people's fear of clowns? I always found Grimace to be much scarier. He always freaked me out a little bit.
Yeah, because everybody's like, what is this? I don't know. And of course, I don't get it. You don't serve anything purple. What is this?
Of course, what is it? The Whopper cop or whatever it is? The Big Mac cop? Ever since ACAB, right. They really like had to step that back as well.
Right. Yeah, everybody protests on the side of the Hamburglar now. And you know, yeah.
You know what I just recently learned? Do you know who the original Ronald McDonald was?
John Wayne Gacy.
You're very close. It was Willard Scott of the Today Show. He was the original. Right. He was the original Ronald McDonald, and it was a much creepier design too. Like he had a tray of French fries for a head. It's bizarre.
I don't like that. I don't like that at all.
And he lived in a sewer for some reason in Derry. I'm not really sure why.
Yeah, and he ate children and problematic bullies. Yeah. So. Yeah, was it the audiobook that you were listening to when you got into trouble with Ashley? Because one of the early, I mean, listen, I would of course welcome you on the show at any point because you were we were friends together. But I remember when you mentioned, I think on your show, you know, how Ashley would always walk in like you'd be listening to an audiobook of a Stephen King audiobook, and she'd always come in at the wrong moment or something. And like all of a sudden, you know, the Discord lit up and all the listeners were like, hey, you need to get Bernie and Ashley on the show, blah, blah, blah. Was it that happened to you with, or was it a different one?
Specifically, it was that when she walked in was Three Body Problem, not related to Stephen King. But then she also walked in. That was the first one she walked in on. But then she also walked in on Thinner. You know, also not Stephen King, technically, Richard Bachman. But yeah, she walked in on me listening to Thinner, which has a wonderful like hand job scene in it. And it was great. It was really great. You know,
yeah, the hand job that causes the accident that angers the Romani people. And yeah, that's how it all starts. Yes.
And then it led to an amazing cookbook that somebody got as a gift.
And then somebody snuck into a gift guide like 12 years ago. Yeah, because I've heard stories of people. I think maybe it was a story that Wampler told about listening to the It audiobook that Steven Weber narrates and does it just a bang up job. It's such a good read of the book. But it was something about his wife, like coming in, or his, you know, soon to be ex-wife, but his wife walked in while the just in time to hear the sewer gangbang or the train God, section.
It's so tough. Yeah. It's, and, in fact, it's like one of those things. I feel like you watch everyone go through a little bit of PTSD when they talk about it, because they talk about how much they love the book and how incredible it was to read it for the first time. And then they all like this, like door in their mind unlocks and out comes this memory and you watch their face go, oh, and then, the end of the book is kind of...
One of the things that we've kind of examined about that scene, you know, since the beginning of the show, one, it was a topic we weren't sure we were even going to want to bring up. But we, something that I've kind of discovered in talking about it though, is that when I was a kid and I read that scene, it didn't, I mean, it stood out to me, but it wasn't like, oh my God, I can't believe I'm reading this. How dare he write this? It was more like, oh my God, I'm engaged in this in a weird way. It's like, what the hell's going on? This is out of left field. It doesn't make sense. When you read it as an adult, I think about Stephen King, the grown ass man sitting at a word processor, writing those words. And then that becomes like, that's where the ick factor for me comes in, not the actual scene. And we had Emily V. Gordon came in, and she, her background, you know, before she was a Oscar nominated screenwriter for The Big Sick and you know, now the go-to screenwriter hire in Hollywood, her background's child psychology. And she actually came to a full-throated defense of that scene about how it's actually a very positive thing for kids to embrace and deal with. And I just, that helped contextualize it a little bit to me, because I was, and that's when I kind of thought, I'm like, yeah, when I was a kid reading it, it wasn't traumatic. It wasn't like, it didn't feel like the dirty old man, you know, thing. And I think I'm projecting a lot of my adult like weirdness onto it. But again, I also now feel very weird as an adult talking about it and trying to quasi defend it on a large platform. You know what I mean?
I get it. And I feel the same way about it, because reading it as a kid, it didn't bother me at all. And it was honestly one of my first introductions into, you know, like sexuality, you know, especially for sexualities like blossoming adults and things like that.
Right.
At the time, it was age appropriate for me. So is it fair to look back at it through the lens as an adult and look at it and go like, yeah, I get what you're saying there. That makes sense right. to me. That makes sense. I'll have to listen to Emily's interview with you
and
hear her defend that as well. Because
she's way smarter. She put it way better than I did, but yeah.
Also, we tend to get a little defensive these days when we talk about these kinds of things. It's like, I feel like I have to justify that I enjoyed it. And it's a really important book to me, and the way I like formed my personal storytelling and things like that. I have this, it's probably unnecessary that I would feel the need to justify that or call that right. scene out in particular, you know, in a giant, how big is the book? Is it like 900 pages or something like that?
Oh, it's, it must be. Cause I think his longest book is like 1100 to 1200. And that's the uncut version of The Stand, the 1990 version.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's just right under that. It's got to be 950 or something. Yeah.
But yeah, so I read it. I read The Stand. So my Stephen King origin story honestly probably started with movies. I remember my brother was always allowed to go see, he saw Halloween in theaters and he would always talk about it. He was very much into, you know, horror movies and things like that. So honestly, if I had to say, my first ever experience with Stephen King would probably have been the movie adaptation of Cujo. That's probably my first experience with Stephen King. And then I think maybe even the first thing I might have read might have been Pet Sematary. Might have been the first thing that I read.
Well, that's kind of jumping into the deep end there. That's like
it really was
legitimately really was. One of his darkest stories. Yeah.
Well, to me, growing up, the litmus test of whether or not you were a tough kid was whether or not you cried at the end of E.T. and whether or not you had seen Dawn of the Dead. You know,
yeah.
And so Dawn of the Dead was this thing. It was, it, you know, it kind of like there's other things like Faces of Death, but like Dawn of the Dead, I had heard had been banned in some states and things like that. And you were a tough kid if you had seen the entirety of Dawn of the Dead. And, you know, Pet Sematary reminded me of some of that. And so I've always had a kind of a fascination with, you know, the zombies and the zombie apocalypse and things like that.
Yeah, no, geez, I mean, it's weird how that was such a big deal for 80s, 90s kids. And I think it's fairly out of the conversation, sadly, for a lot of the newer kids. Because I follow a lot of folks on like TikTok, and there are a lot of people out there that are like in it for the right reasons. It remind me of kind of young me's, right? That clearly love cinema, that they examine stuff, and they'll do it in a format that, you know, I kind of instinctively like. Reflexively pull back from, like, here are the five scariest movies of all time, you know, those kind of BuzzFeedy kind of things, because they have to do it in a minute and a half or whatever. They might bring up some like Criterion kind of horror, they might bring up, you know, like real vintage great stuff that shows that their taste go beyond just like what they saw as a kid, but they never mentioned Dawn of the Dead, and it really strikes me. I don't know if it's just a complete disconnect of it's not, you know, because it's so available, and sometimes it is, it goes out of print all the time, but you know what I mean? Where it's like there's a billion editions. You can find, you know, the one of the 74 Anchor Bay releases of it. You know, it's like, yeah. Maybe it's because it's easier to find, or maybe it's because, you know, that it, there's an inherent camp in Dawn of the Dead that doesn't ring through as scary anymore. I don't know. I don't know what it is, but like, you're right. Dawn of the Dead was like the dangerous movie when I was growing up.
Well, it's also too, it's sometimes it's hard. And there are certainly movies that predate you and I, you know, because I saw Pulp Fiction before I saw Citizen Kane, you know, and it's hard to go back and have the appreciation for Citizen Kane after you've seen the refinement through like generations of other artists and then being inspired by that original material and then making something that's more in a modern voice. Then when you go back and watch, you know, Citizen Kane, you go back and watch Wizard of Oz, you go back and read or see Dawn of the Dead or read The Long Walk, you know, or The Running Man, and you see like what, you know, all those things led to, it's hard to go back and see the original thing and say, have the same gravitas that it had in that moment. There's some things you'll never be able to recapture. Because that time in the world has moved on, you know, in part because of that work.
Right.
And so it's hard to go back and get the same appreciation. Like, go back and watch Psycho today. And you're like, people ran out of the theater because of this? This is why people were, So, and it's hard to imagine. You know, how can you go watch Psycho in a world where long legs exists? Or Serbian movie, you know? Yeah,
Serbian film.
Yeah.
Show a Serbian film to 1960 audience. That's okay. Now I need to invent a time machine just so I can see them react to that.
Yeah, you'll be executed immediately. Oh
yeah,
no.
Yeah, you're a warlock, a satanic warlock. Yep.
Yeah, I just can't imagine it. You know, and even like you look at Dawn of the Dead, and I was talking about how crazy the horror and slasher films, like some of that stuff, some of that gore gets so over the top. And really, you know, Dawn of the Dead is probably one of the main inspirations that caused those directors to lean in that direction.
Welcome to the mid-roll ad read. You know, Deadpool and Wolverine just pulled in almost $500 million at the worldwide box office in its first weekend. So, of course, that means it's time to talk about the other thing that made Ryan Reynolds extremely rich. Yes, I'm going to be telling you a little bit about the good folks at Mint Mobile. After years of fine print contracts and getting ripped off by overpriced wireless providers, if we've learned anything, it's that there's always a catch. So when I heard that for a limited time, all Mint Mobile wireless plans were $15 a month when you purchase a three-month plan, I was like, what's the catch? Well, turns out there isn't one. Mint Mobile's secret sauce is that they sell wireless service online. They don't have retail stores or salespeople they need to pay. Instead, they deliver premium phone plans directly to you, the consumer. The best part is all plans come with high-speed data and unlimited talk and text delivered on the nation's largest 5G network. And you use your own phone with any Mint Mobile plan, bringing your phone number along with you. That means not having to reestablish your contacts or sending embarrassing texts to your friends and acquaintances and making sure their info is on your device. Now, we know most cell phone companies suck and are ridiculously overpriced, so I'm glad a company like Mint Mobile is in the marketplace to offer high-quality service at low prices. It's hard to beat 15 bucks a month, folks. To get this new customer offer and your new 3-month unlimited wireless plan for just $15 a month, go to mintmobile.com/kingcast. That's mintmobile.com/kingcast. Cut your wireless bill to 15 bucks a month at mintmobile.com/kingcast. And they insist I add this disclaimer. $45 upfront payment required, equivalent to $15 a month. New customers on first 3-month plan only. Speeds are slower above 40 gigs on unlimited plan. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for details. Now let's get back to the show. So the reason why you're here is not that I don't love talking about it and a bunch of other cool Stephen King stuff with you. We should probably talk about the topic at hand. That's The Long Walk, which it's a very timely topic you've brought to me. But can you tell me why you wanted to talk about this title in particular?
Man, I guess I grew up in the, even though it wasn't even close to the Vietnam War, in the post-Vietnam era where movies like Full Metal Jacket and everything, Platoon, were coming out, you know, and it was an exploration of that whole period of time.
Right.
But I read The Long Walk at about that same period, and to me, it was a more allegorical approach to, you know, the folly of youth and the invincibility of youth and the bad decisions we all make that we can't undo once they're done. And it's just like The Long Walk and these young men, 100 young men going into this competition where they can have anything that they want without realizing the repercussions of it. It just really spoke to me. And this was a time before, you know, reality TV. I don't recall if I read Long Walk before or after Running Man.
Right.
But I just felt like it was very prescient. I felt like at the time that eventually we would be doing things like this. I guess game shows were a big deal, but nothing quite like reality TV. So I was just – it really spoke to me. And I could really put myself – in the shoes of not just the main character, but all the characters, just like that moment of realization where I've made such a critical mistake and there's nothing I can do to get out of this.
That kind of folly of youth, that feeling of your brain might recognize mortality, but you know, there's something about being young where you don't fully grasp it. You never think it'll be you, right?
No, you never think it'll be you. Yeah. You're the hero, right? You're the hero of the story.
Right. And it's I remember hearing old people say that, old people like me now saying that when I was a kid, going, no, of course, I'm not an idiot. I can go get hit by a car. I realize that I'm mindful of that. But there is something that like a deeper understanding of that as you grow older. And, you know, I don't know what it is. Maybe it's just, you know, shaking your old man shaking fist at the clouds, talking of like, I now know better or whatever, but it really does feel like that kind of, that's one of the center points of the story, is that everybody who's in there, everybody thinks they're going to be the winner on this thing. Everybody knows that there's a 1 in 100 shot, you know, of getting this. Logically, they think about it. They know that, you know, with their brains, but none of them act like they're going to be anybody but that one winner, which to me feels like it's very much a direct commentary on, you know, how the youth kind of feels about their own mortality.
And I've been rereading it since you and I talked about doing this podcast together. And I'm not fully through an entire reread, but one of the things I love about it too is the hollowness of the victory at the end.
Right.
And also just the prize itself being kind of this nebulous, not fully discussed thing. Like, I think everyone who finishes it or admires the piece, everyone has a different idea of what the prize is. Like, some people think it's whatever you want for the rest of your life. Some people think you can select one thing. I mean, do you have an idea of what the prize is specifically?
I mean, not in a specific way. It's not like, and the pot is $1 million and, you know, congratulations or whatever. It is that, like, I think they describe it as it's like you get whatever you want for the rest of your life, right?
Right. That's how I took it too. Yeah.
Which, you know, on the surface is like, that's probably the best like way to trick a genie, right? You get three wishes and just like, well, okay, then one of my wishes, I get anything I want for the rest of my life. And then that way you can essentially, that's your shortcut into, you know, a million wishes, you know. But you're right. It's like, it could be the monkey's paw thing. You're like, you get everything you want, but, you know, at what price? And that's kind of ultimately what happens. And we were talking about sleep deprivation earlier, but not to start talking about this title and then instantly jump to the end. But, you know, by the end of this, our hero, who ends up being the last one standing, he wins, but he doesn't win. He keeps walking, and he keeps in front of him. He sees that the walk isn't over. He sees the spectral visions of the other walkers. He sees a lone figure, you know, that a lot of people have interpreted as death. Some, you know, you can just, I don't know if it's that deep. It might be like he's walking towards death, of course, and symbolically, but you know, ultimately I think he's just, you know, in that obsessive state where he's broken mentally at this point, and he just has to continue walking because there's still somebody he has to beat, or else, you know, or else he loses his life. Right. And he just can't ever change that. So,
and I was one of those people who always interpreted it as death, that it was the physical embodiment of death. And that's the only competitor that he really had in the entire walk the entire time.
Right.
And likewise, to me, something that's always spoke to me is, you know, without really stating what the prize is or people knowing what they would get, is the realization at the end of it is that if you could have anything, you would just have the chance to get out of it, to get your youth and your limitless potential back. You know, that, that sky is the limit, open horizons of being a young person, and you don't realize it until it's gone. That is the ultimate gift that you could ever get. And you watched 99 people just throw it away or realize at the last minute they gave that up, not knowing it was the most valuable thing they could have anyway. Always, it's just an amazing piece. Always spoke to me. I always loved how the characters come together. And then ultimately, you know, even as they're coming together and forming groups, that they're going to have to fall apart. And they do. And the way they treat each other and rationalize it. It's just, it was always a really just really powerful piece to me. And I always loved The Long Walk.
Well, you mentioned the reality show thing. And it's so crazy to read this story now and one, see how prescient it is, right? And how not just for society and how we always kind of turn to entertainment to kind of distract ourselves of the world falling apart kind of thing, but also just like legitimately this and The Running Man really predicted where game show television would go. And you've actually taken part very, very famously in a reality show. And so I can only, I want to ask if The Long Walk helped you at all when you did The Amazing Race.
No, I can't say it did because there was never the threat that if we came in last in a leg that we weren't going to get to go home. You know, it was, you know, and it, the prize was very specifically stated at the beginning as well. But no, it's funny because I never really thought about it. I really thought about it more, The Long Walk, I think, with the rise of things like American Idol. And I think about it with here in the UK, I think about it with Eurovision. I don't know if you're familiar with Eurovision. Yeah, essentially like the big international singing competition. And that existed back when The Long Walk was published. But I can't really think, Eric, when we were kids, when you were a kid, was there anything that had like the national zeitgeist of like a Survivor season one or an American Idol?
I mean, not quite. American Gladiators was maybe the closest, you know, where it was just normal people fighting against big muscle people that were, you know, I don't know, better at climbing ropes and shooting tennis balls out of air cannon guns or whatever, you know?
Yeah. But it was like, when the walkers, when they travel through a small town, like everyone's out, especially as the competition gets further along, it's one of those things that feels like it has the attention of the entire world, if not just the nation, you know, in the story. And it's like, as a kid, it was like, I don't think we really had that. Like the only thing I could really compare it to was the moon landing, where everyone was like just enraptured by this event.
And the even final as a kid, episode of MASH.
The final episode of MASH or, you know, later on the final episode.
I mean, sports.
Seinfeld. Yeah.
But it was everyone had their like eyes on these like nobodies, you know, that were just, it was a chance for someone to go from complete obscurity into just the biggest possible stage in the world. But what do you have to give up in order to do that?
Right.
And until some of those like really high level productions, like American Idol things, I really didn't associate anything else with something like The Long Walk.
It really is how like the Survivor style of reality TV that this kind of predicted, because the thing that grabbed me the most reading this as a kid before this stuff really existed was how the cliques would form, right? And you'd get these moral characters, these friend groups that would start to form in here. And again, that kind of folly of youth, like they have to know logically that only there can only be one winner. So when you help somebody else out, you are fucking yourself over. And you know, of course, this is the worst example of it, where you know, you help somebody as Garrity is helped multiple times throughout this, where he could have gotten the bullet, but he is helped out of it and ends up, you know, the person who helped him ends up getting killed, you know, at some point later, and they might have won, you know, if the situation had happened right. I love that feeling of reading it going, here's a bunch of moral characters that are in an essentially immoral situation, and you know, how do they handle it? And then you have the ones that aren't moral at all and that are the assholes of the group that are loudly saying, I can't wait to see you guys die because that puts me closer to the money,
right?
And in reality, that's the smartest move. I mean, that guy doesn't win. You know, he's a piece of shit and everybody hates him, but he's not wrong. You know, whenever you help somebody, you are putting your own life at risk. It's a fascinating conundrum. And I think it's one of the reasons why I go back to this is the fact that King writes these characters just so, he fleshes them out so well. And I feel like I know them. I like them. I don't want to see them die. I'm rooting for Garrity to win because he's obviously the main character, but I don't want to see Stebbins go. I don't want to see any of the other, you know, folks that have like helped him throughout this thing, you know, go. You know, it's a very morally ambiguous tale, and I love how complex it is. And then you, you know, read that King wrote this in college, and you just go, well, you know, fuck the rest of us, I guess. Some of us are just born with this, and you can tell this kind of story like right away.
I love too. It's just something I've always loved about King as well is the world building that he does too also has so much designed ambiguity to where you can fill in so many gaps yourself, like building in the world around The Long Walk. The best indication we get of what that world is like is A, the people they run into when they go through these small towns,
right?
But then the major as well. And the major being this incredibly huge celebrity that everybody identifies with. And the kids are scared whenever they come, you know, within 5 feet of the major at the beginning of the walk. You know, Garrity talks or would discuss his dad being squatted and things like that. I just love that kind of world building where you get a little bit of a hint of it, like a blush, and then you get to fill in all those gaps yourselves or with the context of the characters that have developed within that world.
Right.
I just love it. Yeah.
Yeah. It's very smart. It's very economical. You know, he's not wasting a lot of time giving us an overview of what the world is before jumping into things. Matter of fact, the story starts with Garrity being dropped off at, you know, at this, the pre-sign-in essentially for this competition. And, you know, I don't know. I also love stories that drop you right in the middle of it. And that's kind of what happens here. And you figure it out as you go. I think that's kind of what you're talking about too, in terms of how he's painting the world through the characters and through action. You know, it's a gripping story. It's a very wonderful story. And it's one that I always come back to. It's one that I'm very curious to see how they're going to adapt. You know, they've been talking about doing a movie for a long time. Frank Darabont notoriously had the rights for many a year and couldn't get it off the ground. We had Andre Overdahl more recently, who almost did it at New Line. And now we have a new one that's actually filming as we're recording this. So we finally have one happening. I always figured that this would have been one of the King stories that if they get it right, it's like an all-timer top tier genre movie, period, let alone Stephen King movie. You know, I think the characters are there, and the, you know, it's such a dynamic thing, you know, because nobody can really stop walking, you know, for the entirety of this. Once they start going, it doesn't slow down. The camera can't stop moving. You know what I mean? I think that this is going to be a really interesting exercise. Either Francis Lawrence is going to make an all-timer or he's going to totally drop the ball and fuck it up. I don't think that there's going to be much middle ground here.
Yeah, well, it is tough. It is, you know, and actually when you were talking about Darabont being directed, I don't know if this is true or not. When I was reading about this, apparently in 1988, George Romero was approached to direct the film adaptation, but that never materialized. I don't know. Have you ever heard that before?
I must have at some certain point. It you know, it definitely rings a bell. Not stuff I spent a lot of time thinking about, mostly because when I think about Romero and King, the thing that jumps out to me is they spent like a decade trying to get a stand movie off the ground, which would have been so in Romero's wheelhouse that, you know, it's a bummer that never happened.
Yeah, especially some of the like early stuff with the Superflu would have been amazing to see him do it.
Of course.
Yeah. Yeah. That would have been amazing. But also with Romero, it's like I give him a huge amount of credit for, you know, what he was able to do. I mean, how often can someone just like come up with a new type of like monster or creature, you know what I mean? And whether or not, you know, with the zombies going back to, you know, Haitian voodoo or something like that, the concept of the zombie apocalypse and everything that took over media, it seems like for the last 15 years, that came from that guy. So,
yeah,
but I don't really associate him with him being like a really strong director. Like I don't think about him going out and directing other movies besides the incredible thing that he created. So.
Mm. Right.
But I'm with you. It's like, you know, I think they're going to have to, it's going to be, you know, this natural evolution. At some point, they're going to have to say, like, how much do we explore through flashback? How much do we explore of the world outside of the walk? Personally, I mean, for whatever it's worth, I would love to see them just stay on the walk, you know? I mean, if you try to get the audience to the point where the walkers are, where you just keep going and keep going, like, just relentlessly sticking with it, you know? It could be the kind of thing that could really pay off, I think, with the audience at the end. But it is, I think, it's a really risky one. But right. like you were saying, I think that when I look back across all of Stephen King, I feel the same way about this one on the written page, the way I felt about Rita Hayworth and Shawshank Redemption. Mm. I felt that way so strongly about that story that when Darabont made it into a film, I was so grateful at how well received that story was. And I think, I really think this could be a banger like that one.
Yeah. I think a lot of it really is going to hinge on two or three very key factors. One of them is going to be Cooper Hoffman, who announces the lead. So I assume that's Garrity. And you know, how we see things through his eyes and his interactions, it's going to be obviously a character piece. So that's going to be crucial foundation number one. Crucial foundation number two is going to be the tone and the danger of it. Like, how much are they going to lean into it? Is it going to be as full blown, full throated, bullet to the head, brains on the asphalt, you know, or is it going to be kind of hidden away, the death? And I think that the part of the impact, and listen, I'm not, I like creative gore, but I'm not a guy that like, I have to see all the viscera in order for it to be really impactful. But I think for here, you can't shy away from it or else it kind of lessens the themes that this thing's playing with. Right. So, you know, so I think that's a second foundation is just how threatening everything's going to be. And then the third one is the ending. And like, are they going to go ambiguous? Or are they going to have to go with, you know, they beat the system ending, a hopeful ending, or is it going to be a downer ending? Like, I think, you know, there's pros and cons to all that stuff, but I think all those three things have to kind of line up for it to reach its full potential.
Also too, it's like, you think how much of, especially as you get down to the last five, and his interaction with Stebbins in particular, how much of that takes place within Garrity's head and how are they going to approach that?
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, the mental deterioration, are they just going to show it physical or are we going to get into his brain as he's taking these micro naps and stuff as he's walking and, you know, just physically and mentally exhausted and how all that meets. It's going to be a challenge.
Yeah, you know, and when we made Day 5, we were talking about a little bit earlier, which is basically a apocalypse based around sleep deprivation, we constantly ran into the challenge of how do you make people look tired without making them look bored? Because there's a lot of crossover between those two things. And we had to select really specific scenarios, I think, in order to try to pull that off. But they're locked into these guys walking along, you know, and it's going to be really interesting to watch them, you know, try to communicate that to an audience on a two-dimensional screen. You know, it's going to be, unless they, you know, they could make it an 8-hour long movie. The audience will be right there with them.
Yeah. We're in it for the long walk. It's actually in real time. That's the hook on this. It's going to last for, like, you know, 78 hours or however long.
You can only watch the movie. It will only play if you're on a treadmill and you're powering it. That's the only time the movie will advance frame by frame.
You're walking 3 miles per hour on a treadmill. You go under. You go under that three times, then you don't ever get to watch the movie. Your digital file erases itself. Yeah.
And I don't know about you, but to me, it's like that first moment, you know, when the first person gets their ticket, it gets their three warnings and then falls below. It's the kid with the Charlie horse. Right. It was a really shocking moment to me reading that on the page, but also as a Stephen King fan, in the back of my mind, like the characters was like, I knew this was coming. What else did I think this was going to be? Mm-hmm. You know? And I wonder too, if that'll have, you know, like we talked about before with, you know, Psycho versus every slasher movie we've seen since then. I wonder if that's going to have the same gravitas for people who didn't grow up reading this story. You know, I wonder if this is going to seem like a really simple premise to the modern audience.
Maybe. I mean, I think that that is a danger, but I think that you circumnavigate that by having it be the character study. Because if you give a shit about the characters, then the premise, you know, being simple doesn't matter. Matter of fact, it probably be a benefit. You know what I mean? If we actually give a shit about these characters, and they're casting a lot of very compelling people. There's a lot of people in here I don't recognize that have been announced, but there's a couple of names that stand out. David Johnson is apparently the co-lead, and he is somebody whose work I don't know now, but he's apparently really great in the new Alien movie. I guess he plays the android in the new Alien movie. You know, there's always got to be a Bishop.
I just saw a trailer for that. It looks fantastic.
Yeah, it looks so good.
Yeah, I don't know when that takes place in the storyline, that Romulus, but I definitely want to see it. I was excited to see Roman Griffin Davis from Jojo Rabbit. I mean, I don't think I've seen him since Jojo Rabbit. I'm sure he's been in things, but I'm excited to see him in this. You know, he's obviously a very capable kid actor.
Yeah, and he's charismatic. I wonder if he's like, I'm trying to cast him in my mind. My guess is that he's playing Stebbins, but I also don't know.
Oh, such a dark role. I mean, not that Jojo Rabbit, you know, wasn't a dark role as well, but Stebbins is such a dark role in it, you know. There's also one of the things that happens in Long Walk, which I think will translate really well to the screen, is you learn about most of these characters through the lens of Garrity. And when you hear like everyone's individual motivations, every single time it feels like a huge shock to me. Like even down to Scram, who was the odds-on favorite to win the walk that year. Uh-huh. I believe he gets doesn't he get a cold? Isn't that what happens to him?
They walk through a rainstorm and he gets pneumonia. Yeah, and he gets literally walking pneumonia. And yeah, that I fucking love that, because that's like the dude that should have won, and he's just like, well, this isn't fair. You know,
nope. Not fair, not fair. And then when you hear his motivations for why he's going, are spoilers okay on here?
Yeah, of course. I mean, we opened this discussion talking about the end in detail. So even if we're trying to avoid spoilers, I think that's been out the window for a long time.
Yeah, and so you find out that one of the reasons why he did it is his wife is pregnant and he wants to build a life for them, and he is the odds-on favorite to win. But even in that moment, everyone, you know, who's in the field walking, you know, or on the road walking, they're just like, are you – and you're saying as a reader, are you insane? How could you possibly think this was going to work out? But it's one of those decisions of youth, you know?
Yeah.
For him, I'm sure he was thinking, how could this not work out? For me, it's me, you know, and everything's worked out for me so far. So let's just draw that line out forever. Yeah. So those moments are just like so critical to the story. And I don't know. It's those things. It's amazing those things you take away And Stephen King, I think, has so many great moments like that where, like, I think about The Dark Half, because we're talking about Richard Bachman, right? And a big part of the story, I think, is also this was written as Richard Bachman. And I'm just fascinated with the idea of taking on an alter ego in order to create art. I just think that's a fascinating process. And he talks openly about Richard Bachman as being a separate person. Of course, then there's The Dark Half.
Right.
And for some reason, it's like of all the things in Stephen King, I remember so much the thumbprint in a wad of gum in The Dark Half. And it's like, it's amazing sometimes the imagery that sticks with you. Even though, I'll be honest, I didn't really respond to The Dark Half as much as I responded to a lot of his other works. But somehow that, for some reason, that image sticks in my head.
Yeah.
Like so incredibly strongly, more so than other things I've read all along the way, even things that I've like carried with me, like The Stand and It for the rest of my life. You know?
Right.
He's a great writer. Well, just phenomenal writer.
Well, and you know, the idea of a pseudonym, you know, isn't a new one, but it also, once you wrap it up in like all the things he was prophetic about it with his Bachman work in particular, you know, we talked a little bit off mic about this, but you know, the world is filled with screen names and alternate names and pseudonyms. You know, I cut my teeth as Quint. Nobody knew my real name for the first 10 years of my career. You know, it's like, you know, we wrote as online personas, people in social media. I mean, one of the more famous and oddly influential fucking right wing dickheads out there is named Cat Turd. You know what I mean? It's like, and people like in real positions of power, like are like, yes, Cat Turd, I agree with you. You know what I mean? It's like, it's so we're so beyond the veil right now in this stuff. But I don't know if there's an actual like end thought here other than when you kind of wrap that in, it just feels yet another layer of King somehow guessing where everything was going to go at some point. And I hope he was wrong about how far things will go, especially when we look at The Running Man and The Long Walk.
Well, in the version that I was reading, there was an introduction where he talked about Bachman, and he was writing it in the late 90s and revisiting the concept of Richard Bachman.
Right.
And I thought it was the way he talked about it was just using the alter ego to explore a different voice that lived within him. And I think, you know, going back to the whole allegory of young people and decisions they make in The Long Walk, I think a lot of people now, they test the waters of communication and how to interact with other people in society by assuming a handle and a moniker and going online, you know, in Reddit forums and things like that. And I think in a lot of ways, that digital persona that they build, that we all build for ourselves online, I think in a lot of ways, that persona reveals a lot more about who we are than the person who walks around in the real world every day, you know? Yeah. And so I think about that with Bachman, especially, I think at some point, you know, Stephen King reached a point where he had such a level of popularity and notoriety, there's a lot more courage and confidence to be who you truly are. But I do think when people are starting out, I think you need to take risks in safer ways. And I think Bachman, honestly, in a lot of ways, I wonder if Bachman is more of Stephen King than Stephen King was back in those days. You know, he could be truer to himself and the voice. Because some of my favorite early works by Stephen King are all of his Bachman books.
Right. There's definitely a different feel to them. I mean, I think The Long Walk maybe is more Stephen King-ish than most of his stuff. And I think it goes back because he didn't write it like, oh, I'm Richard Bachman, I am sitting down to write this as Richard Bachman. Again, he wrote this in college. But I think that college Stephen King was angry young man, like writing about Vietnam and, you know, how it we feed in our youth and it, you know, just churn. We get one back for every 100 we send in, you know, kind of thing. So I think that, you know, what Bachman ended up becoming as a persona was very much more of an angry, cynical writer. You know, the Bachman stories typically don't have very happy endings, these things. You know, they're very mean and lean. I think you're right. They do, like, there is something about tapping into a different voice. I don't know if that voice is more authentically King, but I think he was able to use Bachman, especially at the point where he was really kind of leaning into it and like writing Thinner and all that stuff, where he got to use Bachman as a release valve, maybe, where he didn't have to always just be in the Stephen King voice. You know what I mean?
No, I get you. And likewise, to continue the comparison, if someone goes online under their cat turd moniker and lays into other people, or is, you know, spouts political rhetoric. Is that more the person, or is it the person that they try to be politely in society every day?
Oh, and for sure.
I also don't mean ongoing. I really do think once you get the confidence and the track record to do what you want, I think every artist gets a lot more comfortable to reveal who they are. So, you know, Stephen King is obviously a really strong voice. I think Richard Bachman becomes unnecessary in that world. Although it's cool, I didn't know this. He revisited Bachman with Desperation and The Regulators. Yeah, with the mirror novel, The Regulators. And I never read those. And now I'm curious to go back and read them.
It is. It's a very fascinating double whammy. And that's another thing. We've covered Desperation on the show, but we've never done The Regulators. But I'd love to like dive deep or more deeply into that, because I just love the whole concept of here's how Stephen King would write this story, and here's the mirror story that Richard Bachman would write. And, you know, there, it's not like it's the same story told with different voices, but they play with each other in very interesting ways, so much so that when they release them around the same time, and the covers, like, you could merge the covers together for both of the books.
Yeah.
Very fascinating angle, and very playful. I love playful Stephen King, you know, like when he released The Green Mile and, you know, and little mini novelettes and stuff, you know. You know, when you hit that kind of level of power and success, like, I love that he, instead of turning into a certain wizarding author who has very strong opinions against trans people, you know, instead of going that route, like, he became playful and was like, let's see what I can do with different publishing forms. I'll be the first person to release an original story on a Kindle. You know, it's like, you know, that's the kind of stuff he was going into.
At that point, why not? Why not?
Right? Yeah. Fuck it. Why not? You know, the well ain't running dry anytime soon, right? So might as well throw a story over there, you know, and see how it goes.
But I do think it's interesting to, like, you know, I think we all feel this way. You probably remember very strongly your first big hits writing for Ain't It Cool News. And, mm-hmm. like, I don't know if you ever go back and revisit that stuff. I do with some of my early work. I worked on Red vs. Blue for 14 years before I had a break, and then came back and did the last season at 20 years. But it's impossible not to go back and, like, think of yourself as a different person who was writing back then. That voice is different. It's evolved. And, you know, it's inevitably audiences compare you to it. So it's inevitable that you would compare yourself to that voice as well.
Right.
You know, for me, it was, you know, I was writing under the same name the whole time, but arguably a much different person after two decades. So I've always been fascinated by that.
Yeah. I mean, I've gone back. I mean, there's a lot of the early stuff I don't make a habit of doing it, but when I do kind of look back at things, and mostly I have one of two reactions. One is like, oh man, you were really trying hard to have a voice that people would listen to. Right. It, like, I can feel a lot of try hardness in my early stuff.
Rough edges
and, like, kind of leaning into a persona, you know.
Yeah.
You know, the whole Ahoy Squirts and, you know, especially my very, very early stuff. It was just like, it was more about, like, I would pretend to be, you know, a version of Quint from Jaws that was half eaten by a shark. And I would incorporate that into my write-ups. And I think it's a lot of fun, and it kind of has a very creative edge to it that I really like. But it also, again, feels try-hardy. But then the other reaction I have is I'll go back and read something that I remember posting going, man, I didn't get a chance to give this a second look. I hope it reads okay. And, you know, and yeah, I'll find some typos and whatnot in there. But I'll also read it going, fuck, man, that, like, I was actually, you know, kind of cooking with that one. Like, there's been some, like, retrospective reviews that I've gone back to look at, especially in the wake of the Spiel launching. And I've gone back to read some of my writing on AI and stuff. And I'm like, you know, Jesus, this is like, if I just read this cold and, you know, I got hit in the head a little too hard and, you know, I didn't remember writing this, I would have read this going, man, that dude knows what he's talking about. That dude's pretty smart. He said some smart things there.
Yeah.
So I'll have one of those two reactions of, like, the oh God, this is out in the public and anybody can still find it if they search, you can go back far enough. And the other one going, like, oh, look at that. I might've been onto something. Maybe I am okay at this, you know?
One of the things I always found is, because Red vs. Blue is comedy, I wrote so much of it over the course of a decade and a half that I forgot a lot of it. Like I had forgotten, like especially individual scenes, like maybe there's some B story and I forgot it entirely. But because my brain wrote it, my brain finds it hilarious. So if I forget it, I get to watch it and then I'll go to like a screening or something and I'll be in the back laughing at all my own jokes. I must look like the biggest prick in the world.
It's you and Tarantino, man. I've been in the audience with Tarantino watching his own movies a couple of times, and that dude, and because he you know he wrote it and he you know made it and spent you know 8 months editing it and examining every scene, like why he knows when the jokes are coming, so he'll start preemptively laughing at his own shit. And like nobody loves a Quentin Tarantino movie more than Quentin Tarantino. And,
that's so great. And I love that. I love it.
There's something so wonderful about that. It should come off as an egotistical asshole, but there's something just so childlike and pure about it. Yeah, you know, like I've seen him. Well, let's see, Jackie Brown, Inglorious Bastards.
Gosh, you know what, Eric? Before we met, we might have been at the same screening of Jackie Brown in Austin. It's entirely possible. Was Tarantino there?
Yeah, of course. Yeah,
I think we might have been at the same screening.
And was it the Dolby?
Nah, I want to say it was like some theater up north, like the Galaxy or something like that.
It was something where it was multiple screens that were showing it at the same time, right?
Yes, definitely.
It was through the AFS. I remember getting my tickets through the AFS. But yeah, no, like I was at the premiere from Dusk Till Dawn at the Paramount, and you know, and you could hear him laughing at his, you know, his own, you know, self up on screen and shit. You know, that's, I don't know, there's something endearing about that.
Can I ask you a question too? While we're talking about like, you know, influential artists and people we admire, Stephen King is obviously in that for me because his work always spoke to me. You know, really formed some of my early storytelling, and you know, and still to this day, I think about his work and everything I read as a young person. Have any of the other people who have come on your podcast, have they ever talked about this specific aspect? Because there's one specific thing, and it's a very small thing, that Stephen King did that really helped form my idea of writing as a craft and as a vocation. And that was at the end of all of his stories, he would always simply say a date, two dates, when he started it, when he finished it, and where he finished it usually.
Yeah.
And I don't know why that was so important to me. There was something about him doing that, this really small thing, that after reading this incredible story, it was this sudden little moment where it grounded the whole thing. It's like, oh, this is a guy. This is a person doing this. A writer sitting down and creating this thing and crafting it out of thin air. And it gave me this huge inspiration every time I read that I could go out and I could be a writer and I could do this too. And I wonder if anyone has ever spoken about that specific aspect of it.
A little bit, but not in that way, not in that like that inspired me way. The times that it's come up, and I think it's mostly been me bringing it up because I do love that too. I call them like the fireside chats with Uncle Stevie, right? That's where he's just the, oh shucks, it's Steve here. I'm going to tell you a little bit about why I wrote this story. And, you know, I'm writing in, you know, Maine, and there's a blizzard going on outside and blah, blah, blah. You know, and he starts just painting the picture. And I've usually brought that up as a, quite an ingenious way to kind of, I know it sounds cynical, but in brand building, where it's like, I'm this guy, this is just me, I'm going to tell you a little bit, give you a peek behind the curtain of like where some of the inspirations came from, what I was thinking about, what was going on in my life. He does it in a very personal way. So this is kind of like pre-YouTube or whatever, where you get to know the person making the quote unquote content, a word I fucking hate, content.
I hate the word too.
It's, you know, you get the guy that did it and you feel like you know him and that he's talking directly to you, and it helps form a personal connection, which then forms community as you are like one of the, you know, experts of doing, like the RT community, the Rooster Teeth community is unlike anything that I've seen before or since in terms of size, scope, and just dedication to what you're putting out. And I think that, you know, that was King's version of it. He made a direct connection. And in your case, you found it a very inspiring connection.
And for me, Yeah, and for me, it sounds like you were getting like the like his author notes at the end and the that he would write afterwards. For me, it was just the dates of when he wrote this and when he – it was literally that, because every time I've ever finished a book that I admire, I have never been able to describe quite what that feeling is of accomplishment and almost like a little touch of loss and grief that I'm done with this world. And something about having those dates there – of when he finished the story, to me, it like brought it back to the real world. And it also kind of served as almost like an epitaph, like almost like a gravestone, you know, for it as well. And, and fed into that feeling, but also then brought me back around to realizing it's like, yeah, this is a person in the world who was doing this at that time. And it's just, it's really very specifically those dates, reading those dates, those always just really connected with me. I know it's like a really small thing, but I just wonder if anyone else has experienced that as well.
Yeah, maybe. Let us know. You know, I definitely clocked it as you said, you're reading something, and most of the times these were very impactful stories for me, these books. Even if it was like Needful Things or, you know, one of his lesser novels, it was still something that marked a time and place in my life. And just to have a date, it felt like a historical record. You know what I mean? And I did clock it in that aspect, but I always tied them to his author notes because, again, like I read a lot of Crichton in school, not like as part of class, but like that's when I was reading King was when I was in late elementary, all of middle school, all of high school. So I associate, you know, King a lot with, you know, reading in my downtime at school. But the other authors I was reading around that time were Peter Benchley and Michael Crichton and a little bit of Bradbury. And I don't remember any of them doing that where it's like, all right, now set a spell and I'll tell you why I just told this yarn to you and describe what's going on in my life. And, you know, and here's the date, you know, and I just remember that just really connecting me to King, or at least it made me feel connected to King. Maybe I'm coming across as a little Annie Wilkes-ish right now going, I know him. He's my friend. He was talking to me.
But, well, another artist that a lot of young people read in the author that young people read in the 80s was Piers Anthony did that as well. He's the only other person I can think who did exactly what you're talking about.
I never read any of this
stuff. That was like Xanth and some other series that he did, but Xanth was probably his most popular one.
Right.
But what you're talking about too was, if I may, it seems like it was pretty influential over your early writing, because that was what set Ain't It Cool News apart from other blog sites. Not that there were many blog sites out there, but movie reviews in general, was that you would often tell about like where you were at that point in time in your life and what the day was like before you went and saw the movie.
Right.
And, you know, because that influences how you're going to be, you know, viewing the film that you're watching that day as well. And that was unique for the time. That was really unique.
Well, I mean, listen, Ain't It Cool is, you know, its legacy has been tarnished quite a bit, obviously, but it's kind of hard to stress just how huge it was at its time. And like, I, as a part of it, I didn't even realize it. I just took it kind of for granted. It was like, yeah, this is just what it is. But it is pretty miraculous that even at its low point, we were pulling in like 4 million unique views a month. And that's like, when it was crazy. On the downslope, right? And
crazy.
And you know, it's what's really crazy to put that in perspective. And I remember right around that time, I was like, oh, I was complaining to Aaron Morgan, you know, our mutual friend. And I was just like, yeah, no, it sucks. The readership's down. We're at 4 million. And he was like, dude, you know, like Fox News is like jumping around saying that they're number one in ratings, and their ratings are like 2.7 million. You know, and so it's like, you know, it's like you realize how big that is. And I think a lot of it, honestly, was, you know, a lot of it was that we would get scoops early on, and we coasted on that a lot. And people came to us to, you know, get the info that Hollywood didn't want us to know. So there was that kind of hunger. We were very protective of cinema as an art form and very pro creator instead of pro studio. You know, when that dried up, you know, or got a little less, and other sites were beating us in that regard, like I think what kept people sticking around was that by that point they felt like they knew us, like they had their favorite writer, they had their, you know, the one that they would tune in to watch, and they had connected to. And I think Rooster Teeth had a very similar growth where it started, you know, with you and Gus and, you know, Matt and, you know, and everybody. But like, as you grew, you know, became Barbara and Gavin and, you know, the Achievement Hunter guys, you know, where people, you kind of built this coalition where there was a voice for anybody in your community that, you know, to gravitate towards. And they could all like, they could like you all equally. But there was always going to be one that they were always more excited to hear about. You know what I mean? So,
yeah. And ultimately, I think though, some of those things too were hurt in the long run because it wasn't one cohesive audience. You found out after, you know, 20 years that a quarter of the people were there for one thing, a quarter were there for another thing. And it's like, it was all under one roof and it probably just got to be just, you know, just an unsustainable entity at that point.
Right.
Well, can't be everything to everyone all the time.
That's true. That's true. But you know, and I kind of the, I don't know how to shake the personal thing though. I mean, when Scott and I started the KingCast, you know, we established pretty quickly that we wanted to be a very conversational show. We wanted to put a lot of our own real life personalities into it, which, you know, I think is kind of the reason why a lot of people took Scott's death really hard. You know, people that never knew him other than, you know, listening to his voice every week, because he was his authentic self here and he put a lot of himself into the show. So a lot of people who never met him once, like miss him, you know, as they would miss a close friend. And it's, I don't think you would get that if it was just like us kind of up here being, you know, the literary critic version of this show, you know, not saying that there isn't a space for that, but I think that there's a deeper connection that's formed when you put yourself wholeheartedly into what you're doing. And I don't know any other way of doing it. Every time I've tried, you know, like when I've been hired for a freelance piece where I have to write in a neutral magazine style or something, those are always the worst things that I've ever written. And, you know, and I'm frankly embarrassed to have my name on them because they don't feel like me, you know what I mean? So,
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. We ran into things. I mean, there were whole terms that were invented while we were, you know, creating, you know, that whole entity of Rooster Teeth. And I had never heard the word parasocial before. I didn't know what that was.
Right.
It seemed like something that kind of generated out of the culture while we were a work in progress. And so, you know, I would warn you about things like that. You know, and with Scott passing away, I would hope as well that people are, you know, treating you well, because another thing that can happen is people can associate their grief of losing someone that they associate heavily with online by, you know, saying that things have changed or things are different. And that's completely beyond your control. And you're a person dealing with that loss as well. And you have to take on everyone else's loss and help them process it. I hope you're doing okay in that process, Eric.
Yeah, I mean, I am, and I haven't heard like a whiff of that, you know, yet. I mean, it's still early days. I mean, we, you know, there's still a lot of Scott's voice out there, you know, with the spiel going out, and, you know, there's months and months of stuff we'd pre-recorded. So, you know, maybe when, you know, there's no more Scott left to share with the world that, you know, people might start airing that. But I got to say that so far the listeners have just been nothing but supportive, and there hasn't been like even a one that's like, oh, that's a bummer, you know, I was only really listening for Scott, you know. Not, I haven't heard, if, and I'm sure there must be people out there, you know, and I would totally understand that, but the fact that they haven't voiced it shows so much more restraint than I'm used to in the internet age, where people just feel the need to talk about it. That said, I haven't looked at any iTunes reviews in the last like 5 or 6 months, so maybe all that bullshit's on there. But I can tell you on the Discord, the emails and the social media contact that I've had, everybody's just been like, whatever you need, we're here to support you, and, you know, we're ride or die for Vespi and all this stuff. And it's been, I mean, it's definitely helpful. It, you know, not that I demand it or, you know, would think less honestly of, you know, because it is the show's going to change. It is changed. And the fact that I'm doing this chat with you by myself on this is, you know, it's a big change. And I understand that's going to, the dynamic of the show changes a little bit, but I also think that's kind of why, you know, I think it makes sense for the show to come to its natural end point at the end of the year, which is what Scott and I were planning on doing. You know, maybe if I was trying to run this for another, you know, another 5 years on top of this, that people would be a little bit more vocal about it. But so far, everybody's been incredibly supportive. So,
Well, you and I went out to dinner shortly afterwards because it happened to be when I was back in town in Austin at the same time. And, you know, I said this to you then, I'll say it to you here as well. It's like, it's a loss of an incredible voice, and it's a loss for you personally as well. And I just want to say how sorry I am for your loss, Eric. Yeah. And I wish you all the best. But right now in this moment, it's just, I'm really sorry for your loss.
Oh, well, I appreciate you, man. Well, dude, let's not end the show on a sad note. Let me circle back to one more thing from the long walk before we wrap things up.
And sure.
We talked about the casting of the kids, and one of the latest things that kind of happened, like literally a day or two before we recorded this, was it was announced that Judy Greer and Mark Hamill were cast in The Long Walk.
Yeah.
And I'm very curious about this because I think there's a couple of ways that this can go. If you just read it and go, they're doing a one-to-one adaptation of the story as it is, then Judy Greer is probably Garrity's mom and dropping them off at the beginning.
Probably.
And,
yep.
And Mark Hamill's probably the major. But I'm wondering if there's something, because they haven't announced who anybody's playing yet. They've just announced cast, who's in it. Nobody's actually said who they're playing. And I'm wondering if there is a world where Judy Greer is the major in this scenario and Mark Hamill,
That's interesting because you were talking about David Johnson being cast, and there's a specific part that a black actor could play if you just took the script straight off the page. But that's right. Not what you're going to do in the modern world for a story that was written, four decades ago.
Right.
So absolutely. They could absolutely do that. It also makes me wonder if Mark Hamill is the major. It makes me then look through the casts, to see who would be playing Stebbins in that case.
Right.
It's just inevitable that you would do that. There is only one person here. I'm looking at IMDb. Keenan Lehman is listed as playing Larson. And I don't even recognize the name of the character. That's the only one that has a character name associated with it.
Yeah, but also, IMDb is tricky because anybody could go in and change that stuff. So
it's like Wikipedia, but it bugs you to make an account every 5 seconds.
Yeah.
Yeah. But Mark Hamill could also, he could also, I don't know about you, the gravitas of Mark Hamill, like he comes with a built-in reverence,
Yeah.
The actor, I mean. But at the same time, it's like I didn't picture someone at Mark Hamill's age as being the major.
Right.
I picked it, and also maybe more like an Ed Harris if I was going to go with someone older than a Mark Hamill. So who knows, I don't have any doubts that Mark Hamill could absolutely pull it off if that's who he's playing. But
especially if you've seen, I don't know if you've seen Fall of the House of Usher, which he just got an Emmy nom, I think, for. And he plays like the guy that can bury bodies and get rid of evidence and that kind of guy in there. And he's very hard edged in that series. So I think he has it in. But I'm with you. I pictured somebody a little bit more. A little younger, a little bit more stoic, but they could also be going with like, hey, I'm a gentle dictator. You know what I mean? I'm a gentle authoritarian.
Right.
You could do that, but also, just the thought of Judy Greer playing it also kind of like, I can see that too. Like I could see there being that, but then I guess you might also, there might be some unwelcome political parallels where it's like, yeah, if you're going to cast a lady when we have a lady running for president, who the right is trying to paint as a dictator like figure and all that stuff, then I don't know.
Former prosecuting attorney turned dictator. Yeah. I get what you're saying there. Yeah. And so, also Mark Hamill, they could flesh out Garrity's father's role, and it could be playing that as well.
Could be.
So who knows?
For all, it might be a cameo. That's the thing with these announcements is you don't know. And sometimes it goes, oh, this guy's going to star in this thing. And then like they're in it for 2 minutes. So for all we know, Mark Hamill's playing the dude that's like trying to give the walkers watermelon, on this side.
True. Could be on TV, like voice acting an animated part. Who knows? But I will say this too. Having seen like so much of pop media now being adapted into movies, we're in the late stages, I think, of the comic book era. There has been a lot of times where a beloved character I've seen who's been cast as them, and we've seen it all across the internet as well, where the reaction is like, how are they going to do this? And then they crush it. I mean, that's been the story more so than miscasting.
is, you know, they bring somebody in. It's like, I've been more surprised pleasantly than disappointed by about a 5-to-1 factor, I would say.
Right.
This point. So, you know, I'm just looking forward to it.
Yeah, me too. And I have a little faith in Francis Lawrence. I know I've talked a little bit about him as being one of the lesser interesting choices as director, other than he's coming with power, which really pleases me, because you need somebody who's coming off of, like, he's got Hunger Games power, right, to kind of fight the studios here and say, this is my wheelhouse. I know what I'm doing. Let me make this as I want to make it. Because I could easily see this being a project that can be noted to death. And you know, again, you have to approach this full-throatedly. You have to be, you can't make a half measure out of the story. And if you do, it's going to really dilute what kind of makes it special. So you need somebody who has the, you know, forgive the term, but huge swinging dick in to come into this and go, hired me to do this for a reason, like a Christopher Nolan, you just step back and let me do what I'm doing. Right. And I don't know if Francis Lawrence is quite there, but I also know he's coming off of just that huge run of all the crazily profitable Hunger Games movies. So,
well, you know, looking back at his filmography too, and I don't know the story behind it, but he directed I Am Legend with Will Smith in 2007. And I Am Legend was a beloved piece that, you know, people grew up reading. And when it made its way to the screen again after Omega Man, you know, people were really interested to see how it was going to be interpreted. It was fantastic. The ending was very different, but the ending was very important to the story for I Am Legend. It's very important to the title of the movie. And then it came out later that there was another ending that was more appropriate for the original story. There was that original ending, and I'll just call it the director's cut ending, and that became wildly popular online.
So right.
I hope that gives him the ability to say, like, look, if we'd have gone with my original ending, this would have been a much more popular movie and better received, especially by the core fan base that loved the story. So, and that could play well to something like The Long Walk. Here's hoping, at least. That's my, like, optimistic, I have no information, filling in all the gaps myself. That's my most optimistic interpretation of that.
Right. Yeah. We're rooting for it. We want this to be great because, you know, we want to, the potential is amazing for the story, and like the groundwork is already laid. We're going to get like one good shot at this. I think the Dark Tower might be able to be resurrected quicker than I would have thought, but I had the same feelings with the Dark Tower. You fuck that up, you're going to bury it for a generation, right?
Yeah.
Thank God for Mike Flanagan and, you know, him chugging away at that. And hopefully he gets his version up and we can forget about the other one. But I'm feeling like The Long Walk is like that without the money signs you can paint for, if you sell it right to people, of like, this is a long running series or a long running franchise of, you know, that's really weird and could be your next big hit, you know. But I feel like you fuck up The Long Walk, that's going to be the one and only shot that we're going to get at getting this movie done. So,
yeah. Well, the good news about that is, and I think you would agree with this, is The Long Walk is a movie. It's not a digital series, right? So just the fact they're making a movie out of it, if they were making this a digital series, I would be pretty concerned about that, because it is not something that's going to be like one of those ultra long form stories. You know, it's something you can get in and get out of it in an hour and a half or 2 hours, really probably honestly an hour and a half. And I think they can crush it. I'm staying optimistic. I'm really looking forward to seeing it on the screen.
Same. Well, I think we've kind of reached the end of the chat here finally. And I say finally because we've run into some technical difficulties during the recording.
As always.
As what happens. But, you know, I try to stay optimistic and realize that, you know, you're beaming your voice in from half the world away. And I got to have a little grace and forgiveness about technology on that. But thank you so much for coming on and chatting with me, Bernie. I appreciate the conversation. And do you want to do one last plug for your show before we go?
Oh, sure. Absolutely. Yeah. If you want to hear more from me and my lovely and funny wife, Ashley, we have our show Morning Somewhere every Monday through Friday. And it is a morning show wherever you wake up, because it's always morning somewhere. How is that, Eric?
Perfect. That's a perfect note to end on. Thanks for joining me, man. This was really fun.
Thanks for having me, man.
Many thanks to my friend, Bernie Burns, for joining me for that chat on The Long Walk. I always love talking about The Long Walk. It's one of my favorites. I love Bernie. Good dude. I'm really grateful that he came in to chat with me. I really appreciate it. Let's talk a little bit about what's coming up next week on the show. So next week, I'm joined by a great up-and-coming director by the name of Tillman Singer. He directed a great disturbing flick a few years back called Luz, L-U-Z. And he has a new one out next week called Cuckoo, starring Hunter Schafer and Dan Stevens. Now, I saw this at South by Southwest, and I had a blast with it. It's fucking weird, and both the leads rule. I think you're going to dig the movie. If you dig the shenanigans we get up to around here, this is definitely the kind of movie for you. Big fan of this movie, so I really wanted to get him on the show, and thankfully he agreed. And his chosen topic is Maximum Overdrive, which is, you know, puts him even further into the cool kid camp for me. We had a ton of fun talking about Maximum Overdrive. We talk a bit about the just raw star power that is Hunter Schafer and the value that somebody like Dan Stevens brings to a movie. It's a really fun chat. I think you guys are going to dig it. That'll be next week in the KingCast main feed. This Friday on the Patreon, I'm talking about another recent horror flick that got a lot of attention. You might know it. It's called Long Legs. It's kind of taken the world by storm. It's made a shit ton of money at the box office. It's another weirdo movie. Some people love it. Some people hate it. But that's neither here nor there. That's not what we're talking about this Friday on the Patreon. I will be joined by our good buddy, longtime KingCast favorite, Russ Fisher, who has some very strong opinions on how the film Long Legs has a ton of Stephen King tie-ins. You may see a couple of movie nerds stretch a bit with some of these correlations that we're making, but it's a fun chat that hopefully leaves you thinking about the parallels between the runaway horror hit and Stephen King's work. So make sure to head on over to patreon.com/thekingcast and sign up. You'll get that as well as instant access to over 4 years of KingCast goodness with me and Scott doing deep dives into weird King minutia, commentaries, interviews, all that kind of stuff. We like to say if you're only listening to the main feed, you're only getting half the show. So now's the time to get off the fence. Head on over to patreon.com/thekingcast and sign up. And that'll do it. We'll see y'all next week in the main feed for my chat with Tillman Singer all about Maximum Overdrive and his brand new movie Cuckoo. See you then, folks. The KingCast is a Fangoria podcast production. The show is produced, hosted, and created by Eric Vespi, that's me, and Scott Wampler. Tira Ansley and Abby Goel are executive producers. Daniel Danger is our art director. And editing is done by yours truly.